Good for everyone. So let me say a word about the purpose of this seminar and then introduce the speaker, although she needs no introduction, and then hand it over to her. The way we will conduct this today's seminar is through a more of a dialogue, fireside chat, where initially I'll be asking her a set of questions or sometime comments maybe. And providing her an opportunity to share her immense experience and insights. And then we'll open it up to everyone. I see that there's a lot of excitement among the students. We also have a number of students from India, but this is not India specific. I think what Yamini has to say should be relevant to everyone. So our speaker today is Yamini Iyer. She's an extremely impressive like a portfolio and set of experiences and work. And one of her distinctions, if I may add, is that she's also an LSE alum, which it would be remiss of me not to mention. She has specialized in many areas, sociology, but has worked in a number of areas. And I have always found her work to be very insightful. And her work is exactly at the interface of, call it analytics, research, and practice or policy. That is the aim of the seminar. And that's also one of the key aims of the School of Public Policy to equip our students with, to not only learn analytical concept, but also how to know, have the confidence, and have the nous, our ability to apply it in the real world, in the world of practice and policy. So the purpose of these seminars is also to bring the world of practice into the world of academia. And there's no one better qualified than Yamini in doing that. She is has a very impressive like academic portfolio, but has an equally impressive policy work. And among many other things that she has done, Center for Policy Research that she runs is an extremely impressive, renowned institute, which is exactly aimed at influencing public policy, a think tank that aims at influencing public policy through research and analytical work. And it's a unique think tank that it has very highly regarded, very highly respected because of its work. And Yamini has not only led it, but also done some unique work in terms of like, call it like triggering, understanding and supporting building of state capacity, accountability, and many other such topics and social policy, public social protection and other areas. And I know that she's currently also very heavily engaged in COVID-19 policy response in several places in India, several states in India. So we've already circulated her detailed, her CV, and I wouldn't embarrass her further with saying, repeating it. But let me say, I found her one of the most insightful persons and someone who I am sure you'll all appreciate her insights. And I would urge all of you to intellectually participate in this discussion by engaging with her on whatever is something of interest to you. So without further ado, let me hand over to Yamini. Yamini, like, you've done so much and there's so much that I wanted to ask you, and I don't know where to begin. Should I begin with state capacity? How do you build state capacity using analytics? How do we do it from the grassroots level and not just in from the top? So yes, you're centrally based and headquartered in Delhi, but you're also like have a more of a bottoms up approach, like on in some way maybe a combination of both bottoms up and analytics, which is also fed into policy. And your model is also very unique, and maybe you can say something about that also, which is not just having a seat at the table where policy decisions are made, which is the usual way many other think tanks operate, but maybe also influencing the way policymakers think about an issue, so that whether you have a formal seat or not, you're still influencing policy. Either directly the preferences and framework, analytical framework of policymakers, or of those who will then be engaging with policymakers and policy actors. I find that fascinating. It has all kinds of challenges, and I think maybe hopefully you can share some of those also. And on top of those, there are so many other issues compared to like related to India, your own personal journey, any reflections from that experience. How does it look like for a woman to lead on the policy, public policy front? Does it have any lessons for our students? But let me start off with your main, can you say something about why you chose to do this and not something else, and share any insights that you have along those lines? Over to you, Yamini.
Adnan, first of all, thank you so much. You embarrassed me no end with an overly generous introduction, which now sets the bar so high that I don't think I'll be able to meet it at all. So folks, just ignore everything he said, except for the fact that I certainly am a proud alumna of the London School of Economics, which was a really fantastic year that I spent doing a development studies degree. In retrospect, I suspect I should have spent a little bit more of the year inside the classroom and not at the LSE bar. But consequence of doing so was that I made some lifelong friends, and it's been every time I visited London, I've always come to LSE. And I came to LSE when the new library, or what was at the time a new library, it was quite a glitzy, glamorous, and exciting thing to walk through these glass doors. But when I was last at LSE, I saw the fancy new building where the public policy school is as well, which then made me yearn for, maybe if I was a few years younger, I could have experienced the newer, glitzy and more glamorous part of LSE. But it's an absolute honor and privilege for me to be back virtually in LSE, and I hope COVID will permit us eventually to meet in person as well. And I'm also very envious that you all are doing some combination of in-person and virtual. Our lives are still very virtual in Delhi, and I'm virtually sitting in my children's classrooms. And really, that is a torture that no one should have to go through more than once in one's life. But anyway, so Adnan, well, where to begin? Okay, maybe I'll try and sort of merge a couple of your questions into one and sort of weave it into my own personal story. I grew up in an India that was very much at a cusp of transition. In some ways, we were the first generation of sort of metropolitan Indian elite, so to speak, that began to experience the fruits of economic reforms. So for those of you who are not familiar with India's economic history, post-independence, India went down the path of a sort of mixed economy, much more state-led industrial development pathway. And in some ways, over the late 1960s, and particularly through the 1970s, we saw a moment of fairly significant economic nationalization and centralized state-led industrialization, which in many ways was considered at the time to be one of the reasons why the Indian economy was not being able to sort of unleash itself and grow. We had a sort of 4% rate of growth through the 70s and early 80s. And this was also the time when across the world, the fruits of capitalism were beginning to be felt, and the state was retreating to a degree, particularly from running markets more towards regulating and managing markets. The Indian state too was India's elite certainly were beginning to recognize that a heavily state-driven industrial policy was in fact undermining industrial productivity and was certainly at attributed to be one of the key reasons why the Indian economy wasn't being able to achieve its full potential. And in 1991, a balance of payment crisis created the opportunity for large-scale market reform. The Indian economy opened up very much around the framework of not so much retreat of the state necessarily, but certainly getting the state out of the way of running the Indian economy. We still, till today, have nationalized banks, but on many other fronts, the Indian economy opened up, significantly opened itself up to more, to become much more embedded into what was also becoming a global opening up of trade and sort of. It at least appeared as though India had the potential to start going down the path of the East Asian economies of exporting its way into prosperity. And it was a very heady moment for many in India, in certainly towards the mid-1990s. So in 1991, we went through this big economic reform moment. And of course, there were many pulls and pressures. India still had a very politically strong left, as well as socialist sort of politics that had many questions about opening up the Indian economy. But the dominant zeitgeist of the day was very much in favor of liberalization. And very, very quickly, we began to experience the first sort of wave of growth, of economic growth. And it was in that phase towards the latter half of the decade of the 1990s that I was in college. And for all of us in big cities in India, you know, there was a sense of a sigh of relief as the stifling, it was referred to as the license raj. The government, the state would basically determine industrial policy, industrial licensing, and therefore the nature of the market. And it was the license raj that we were all being freed of. And so the narrative was very much about a world that was opening up to all of us. In which the state was beginning to sort of retreat itself. And personally, my peer group in university was looking at some combination of going and doing management degrees, getting into the private sector that was just beginning to professionalize and proliferate. The United States was and Wall Street was opening itself up as a grand moment of opportunity too. And what was particularly interesting is that many of my peers were all children of the Indian state, in the sense that most of our parents were either serving civil servants or had some anchor in the Indian state, because post-independence, a combination of nation building, patriotic nation building, as well as social mobility, meant that most people, most of the elite certainly found their way into the Indian state as the source, as the means through which they made their lives. But none of us were encouraged to think of professional lives inside the state. And people like me, who were less interested in private sector and much more intrigued and keen to be participants in this sort of moment of change by engaging in the public sphere, also were encouraged both by our families as well as our professional sort of university colleagues and others to look for ways of engaging with the state outside of the state itself. So nonprofits and public policy institutions were still very much in their nascent stage. Of course, India had a very, very vibrant civil society, and activism and NGO innovation was beginning to was an important part of what made for public life in India. But even that sphere was beginning to professionalize itself. So it almost seemed like the obvious thing to do for somebody with my interests was not to go into sitting for the civil services exams, but to spend a few years, studying and exploring the world. So I made my way to the United Kingdom. I spent 2 years in Cambridge and then came to LSE. But to find one's way into the nonprofit sphere, which was really actually at that point a very exciting space of innovation and experimentation. And so when I finished my degrees and I joined an NGO and began to travel outside of the state into outside of the city, big cities that were all beginning to, you know, really experience the joys of opening up and of globalization and of being interconnected with the world. I remember when I came back from Cambridge, the thing that I missed the most were these little coffee shops where you could buy, not quite afford to buy the coffee, but sit around and observe other people drinking the coffee. And we didn't have these kinds of opportunities in Indian metropolitan cities, even place cities like Delhi. And then suddenly towards in the early 2000s, new coffee chains started. So our own indigenous versions of Starbucks, Cafe Coffee Days and baristas started opening up, and, you know, life just sort of, lots of new things were happening. It was a very exciting opportunity. But once one started traveling outside of the city, I realized that everywhere we went, especially in parts of rural India, the narrative was completely different to everything we were listening to and experiencing in our lives and in our drawing rooms, which is mostly a sense of freedom from the state. Here, there was this yearning for the state. Wherever we went, people would talk about, you know, the state will come, the government will come, the government will make a school, our children will get educated, the government will make a road, we can access markets, the government will mobilize our women, we can start self-help groups and do and microcredit and microfinance at that time was a big innovation, and there was lots of NGOs that were beginning to create these, and government too through a World Bank loan was beginning to set up these large-scale self-help groups and small-scale lending and microfinance initiatives, so banks will come, but it was all to be led by the government. And it was quite, the contrast was quite stunning. There was this yearning for a state that was that was nowhere to be seen. Yet embedded in this was another narrative. There was a yearning for a state that was going to be the source of social mobility and access to the better life that I certainly had now begun to experience. And at the same time, the state was invisible. It wasn't really there. Yet for those who did have access to the state, there was also a counter narrative of an extremely oppressive, corrupt state that was failing people who were desperately in seek of the state that was going to deliver. And I think emerging out of this counter narrative on a personal level for me, I began to recognize how important the voices that were worried about the retreat of the state in that moment of globalization actually genuinely were. One had dismissed it as just voices of the old guard, at least in the elite narratives that we were used to listening to. But there was some truth. There was certainly a kernel of truth to this. And yet it contrasted very sharply also with this other narrative of the Indian state, which, you know, growing up in our public culture, public imagination, the books we read, this corrupt, evil patronage state. And in India, we have a phrase called Mai Baap Sarkar. So the government that would hand over, it was your mother, your father, it would hand over its largest at its own behest. And of course, in our books, we had learned all about the clientelist state, the patronage state. And you could see all of this very visibly, all the political science theory that one had read being played out in front of you. But what was also happening, so all of this sort of made me very interested in realizing that even though I wasn't a participant in the state, my interests were not so much in the innovation and experimentation of development ideas that were emerging through NGOs and social entrepreneurs that were still very nascent at the time. My interest was really in trying to get the state to do its job better. So, and it really came from the fact that everywhere I went, people were talking about this, you know, this absent government. But once one started engaging with that, there was also this other reality of the patronage state, the clientelist state, the state that was seeking bribes from the poor at every stop of the way. And it also happened to be a very important moment in India's civil society and social movements evolution as well. Because just as I was experiencing this, so of course was the rest of India. And India's civil society has always been this space of deep activism, which has straddled both the political as well as the civic. And often this activism is elite driven. It comes from outside. But emerging from this activism come new innovative ideas. And I happened to be lucky enough to catch that moment when there was a very strong social movement in India that was gathering momentum around exactly this question of what does it take to ensure that the state gives its rights, that the state delivers on its duties. And what was even more interesting about this movement, these movements, was that it had also recognized that this long stretch of post-independence democracy, and that's the other unique thing about the India story. We were a country that us and our friends and neighbors, a country that should have been together, but unfortunately history had other plans, adopted a democratic path at a time when most had dismissed India's ability to survive as a democracy, partly because of a nation that had become a nation in a moment of deep crisis and violence, but also a nation that had adopted democracy at a time of deep inequality, poverty, illiteracy, and given universal franchise. So the Indian democratic miracle, just in that we were able to conduct regular elections and elect new governments on a repeated basis, and that democracy survived, itself was an important achievement. But there was an exhaustion with this kind of representative democracy, and a questioning that India was beginning to have amongst itself of how does one actually deepen democracy in a substantive way. And part of that deepening democracy in a substantive way was the how does one ensure that citizens are able to claim their social and economic rights from the state? And this was really the gap that, in fact, I think economic liberalization was beginning to make even starker, because it was very clear that some parts of India were beginning to gain in ways that were unimaginable. And other parts of India were still yearning for a state that would give them a school and a health system and a road that would be able to enable them to empower themselves to become participants in this growth process. And so the narrative of what it would take to bring the state where it was needed to be, to curtail this so-called imagined or real retreat, but also to reimagine the nature of the state-citizen relationship, was being framed in the grammar of rights, of accountability, of transparency. And I happened to be, starting my career just as all of this was beginning to happen. So it was a very exciting moment to begin to think about some of these questions about state, about the Indian state, how it's structured at the grassroots, why it doesn't exist at the grassroots, why when it exists in a way that is, in fact, far more sort of violent than it is substantive and delivering of rights to citizens. What is it about the state-citizen dynamic that makes it hard for citizens to actually access their rights from the state in a democracy where we were routinely throwing out governments? This was also a phase when India's politics was going through a substantive transition of its own. A new vocabulary was entering our discussions on politics too. We started using the phrase anti-incumbency. Every election was about throwing out a government, not rewarding a government for what it was doing. So it was also a sign that the Indian voter was beginning to get quite itchy feet about the capability of its politicians to deliver on their aspirations and expectations. Having spent some time at the grassroots with NGOs, the thing that began to frustrate me was the question of scale. All this innovation and experimentation was exciting in and of itself. I was learning a lot from peripherally interacting with social movements and, as the sort of accountability transparency narrative was beginning to gain ground. It also so happened that this narrative was beginning to gain ground in academia across the world and in development practice and development theory as well. So there was a lot of new research, some of which I began to study when I was doing my development studies degree at the LSE, on participatory development, on social accountability, on the transformation of governance becoming a central theme that even growth economists were beginning to think about. I felt that this would be a good time for me to sort of take what I was learning, because I felt I was learning a lot, but not quite in the right place that suited my personality. And then made my way into the World Bank. And it just so happened that I came into the World Bank in Delhi at the time when Lan Pritchett, whom I believe spoke with you a few days ago, and other colleagues, Jeffrey Hammer, Junaid Ahmed, and others, all happened to come to India at the same time. And since I had expressed an interest in governance, was put under their team. And the World Bank too had begun recognizing the challenge of governance and the challenge of what it will take to make the state work for the poor, and had just written the World Development Report authored by Lan Pritchett, Jeffrey Hammer, and Junaid Ahmed and others on accountability, which was really, you know, quite a path-breaking piece of work for the World Bank in particular. But I think its frameworks shaped how a lot of the analytical work and literature, as well as some of the operational work around what will it take to make government systems more accountable. What was exciting about being at the World Bank at the time was, A, it was a huge transformation for the World Bank itself to have an institution like the World Bank that had viewed development and development policy from a particular perspective, now beginning to think bottom up rather than top down, was an extremely crucial transformation for the bank itself. And it was quite exciting and interesting to be part of this moment of transition, because it was a very fraught one. Exactly the same debates that were beginning to take place in the public sphere in India. What comes first, growth or capability, which has been the sort of long standing debate in economics as well, was also being played out in its own small way within the World Bank. But the bank was also puzzling over what does it take to make countries begin to improve their health systems, their education systems. There are things we know that are necessary to do, but we don't know how to get them done. And that's where the language of accountability sort of entered the World Bank's space. What I found really exciting about being at the bank was the opportunity to both be a practitioner. I had never anticipated an interest in research, which is why I never went down the road of doing a PhD. Every time I reached that crossroad, I had to ask myself if I would be comfortable being in academia as a career. And it was clear to me, I mean, there was never any grays. There have been many grays in life, but this one was never a gray, that's not where I wanted to be. And I always felt that one should only do a PhD. And I think I was wrong, but at the time I felt that one should only do a PhD if one wants to be in academia, and otherwise one should start getting one's hands dirty in the real world. So the bank seemed to be a good place to experiment at scale, to be very much actively engaged in the real world, but also have the opportunity to hone all that one is learning into an analytical framework and build more from there. And it turned out to be a really exciting and important opportunity for me, because I think a lot of what I learned, a lot of the networks and relationships I was able to forge at that point proved to be a very, very important levers for me through the course of my career. I was very lucky, because big bureaucracies like the World Bank can be very lonely and isolating places. And a lot of how you are able to successfully navigate the bureaucracy depends on how lucky you are with your mentors. And just, it was pure chance and the universe wanting to work in my favor that I happened to be in a team with the kind of people that I got to work with, all of whom really believed in young people, in young talent, in giving them the space, in mentoring them and allowing them to explore and experiment. And I was also lucky that I found along the way in the bank a couple of other research associates who became friends and collaborators and partners in a lot of work that we were trying to do. And one of the things that we did, just because there was a cohort of two or three of us, and I did a lot of writing with some of them, we were keen to use the opportunity of the World Bank to try and do some things that were different. Because one of the being in a place like the bank gives you a really wide range of experiences and opportunities. So you interact with academics, you interact with senior bureaucracy, you interact with local bureaucracy, because we were also part of operational projects. So when the bank goes out to give loans, you have to be part of those discussions and debates. And it took us into the field all over the country. And the one thing that the bank does have is an endless, it certainly doesn't have a shortage of resources, which is one of the big challenges that NGOs have. So I found a partner in crime, and we spent a lot of our time doing a lot of grassroots field-based research. Our mentors at the bank gave us the flexibility and freedom to do this. So it also proved to be a really exciting learning ground for me. But again, even at my time at the World Bank, I felt increasingly that my interest was really in working in India and on India. And being in a bureaucracy that was anchored across the globe, but its accountability is very much to its DC office. I felt that for me personally, I needed to be much more embedded in the Indian ecosystem, because this is where I wanted to make a career. I felt that being in the World Bank in the long term wasn't quite a cup of tea for me, my cup of tea. And it was about then actually that Lant and Jeff and others were also finishing their stint in India. So I began to look at other opportunities. And all the work on accountability that I had learned analytically at the World Bank, operationally from a government's perspective at the World Bank, also happened to be reaching a very interesting and exciting phase of evolution in India too. In 2004, a new government had come into power, and it had set up a sort of progressive group of civil society organizations as called the National Advisory Council, that had spearheaded some very unique legislation and a lot of that legislation was one important element of that legislation was aimed at trying to strengthen the accountability systems, particularly at the grassroots in ways in which citizens and the state engage with each other. So I spent a few years after I left the bank just going back to social movements, going back to these civil society organizations that had spearheaded these new legislation and now were actively involved in its implementation. So we, India, now had a very unique right to information law. It also had a couple of other rights laws linked to social policy and welfare that had embedded in them experiments around social audits and other ways of bringing citizens close to the state and empowering citizens to demand their rights from the state. And I spent a few years observing, participating, researching, writing about these different forms of experimentation. And it was along that path that I made my way into the Center for Policy Research, which is where I've been now for the better part of the last decade plus. CPR at that time too was undergoing its own transition. Policy research institutions in India until the early 2000s were really homes of retired bureaucrats and the occasional scholar. But as institutions go through their own moments of transition, so was CPR. With a new head, there was a big shift towards bringing in more policy practice and policy research, hardcore scholarship into the center. And my predecessor sort of was beginning to build the institution. And when I went to meet him to explore whether or not a place like CPR, which had now started attracting a lot of younger but serious scholarly policies researchers, so unlike me in that sense, and we began talking, he said to me, "Well, the thing is, Yamini, you can spend a few years here, and all we expect of colleagues is that they do their best, and we will do everything in our power to enable that and allow you to do things your way. There are no institutional expectations per se. So if you want to do field work, and if you want to do, if you want to explore what it means to do research that is not academic, but research that feeds into grassroots politics or grassroots policy, here's a space for you to do it. And what I can assure you is both the flexibility and freedom, but importantly, a group of peers that will hold you to account for producing your best." And you know, in a hierarchical Indian institutional setup, to have a head of institution tell you this when you're all of, you know, in your early 30s, it was too good an opportunity. So this was just purely luck. I had no intention of spending a career at CPR. It just so happened that the head of the institution gave me such an attractive offer that was so unusual for an Indian institution that it was too tempting to say no. And well, 10, 12 years later, this is where I've grown up. And you know, through the course of our conversation, I'm happy to talk more about the work I did at CPR, which was really pulling together a lot of what I learned through my work with social movements and the activist world, as well as what I learned at the World Bank on state capacity.
Thanks, Yamini. That was fascinating. Weaving your personal story along with the story of the country and the story of how policy, politics, ideology have evolved over time. I saw several themes in there, including one that I found, like that you started off with, that I found fascinating, was from attempts to bring down the state to bringing back the state and helping strengthen the state and build a more accountable state. That to some extent also seems the journey of my life as well. So it was super fascinating. There are other themes also were very interesting. So let me, we already have a list of questions, but let me ask you one question and then open it up, which is more about like, so we now have a better sense of your motivation, both your personal motivation and the contextual motivation as to why you moved into what you're doing, the current line of work. But to the naysayers, to the people who may not be convinced that it is possible to influence public policy using analytics, or is it possible to build a think tank that actually has an influence in not just condemning or holding the state accountable, but also helping build its capacity. Can you please provide a few examples or one or whatever you could share about from your work or the work of your center where this approach has worked?
So let me try and answer that in two ways. So what is it that we do? What is a public policy research institution? I would say that our work broadly fits into three different ways in which we seek to engage with policy. And in the process of explaining that, I hope I can answer at least some of your question. On the one hand, we focus a lot, and in some ways, that's really the core of the legitimacy that we bring to the table, on building a serious scholarly field-defining research in the areas of our work. Now, why is research important for policy? It's important for policy for the following reason. When you're in the practice of policy, and more than me, Adnan, you will be able to speak to this, you're dealing with the here and now. And, you know, very often when I talk to bureaucrats in India, certainly, and I think it resonates across the board. What people often say is, you know, the thing is that for us, the short term is the long term. And so I'm not going to ask myself, what are the long-term consequences of the decisions I am taking today? Or what is this long-term vision or mission? I have a set of pressures and a real world in which I am operating, and I have to take these decisions today. I don't have the luxury to understand the context. And because I don't have the luxury to think through the context in that way, I'm not really able to necessarily identify what are the levers that will change the status quo. And at the same time, I'm also not able to figure out what are the long-term consequences that intersect with different aspects of the policy sphere that could impact the effectiveness of the decision that I'm taking today. That's one
part. Sorry, just like I can't resist the temptation to just maybe exemplify what you just said, which was fascinating. I remember my boss once have told me, don't think, act. And I think the subsequent journey of my life so far has been an attempt to think and act at the same time. So back to you, Jamie.
In fact, you know, CPR was founded, we turned 47 a few days ago as an institution. And it was founded in 1973 by somebody who was an academic turned policy practitioner. He ended up, he was at the Planning Commission, Dr. Pai Panandikar, in the early 1970s. And we went back to some of his notes, you know, which he had written when he was sort of putting together the framework of CPR. And in those notes, he says a lot of these, and it was quite fascinating to see because, you know, nobody had gone back to this 40 years later. And the only reason we went back is now we are planning our 50th. And so we wanted to put together an edited volume on CPR. And so we started digging around, and his rationale for why India needed a policy research space resonates 45, 47 years later in a way that isn't necessarily a bad thing. It tells you that the art of policy making actually requires multiple stakeholders to participate together. There are the doers, there are the actors, and certainly the doers and actors are going to make the biggest difference of all. But there are those who can create the context and shape the ways in which the doers and actors think. There's also another very critical element of this, which is about shaping the intellectual frameworks within which decisions can be taken that genuinely break the status quo. So if you think back, where did I start? I started my journey in 1990s decade, when India suddenly has this major rupture, major shift in its direction. And everything that India is today and all the challenges we confront are very much can be traced back to the big decisions that were taken in 1991. But the 1991 decision didn't come out of thin air. There was a period of nearly almost two decades where there was a very clear sense amongst India's policymakers, India's academia, India's industrial private capital, that there was something that we were doing in terms of how we were defining our economic policy that wasn't enabling the country to exploit its full potential. And the globe was going through this moment of transition, and India was not being able to participate in that moment of transition. Some of the early books that contributed to thinking differently about the Indian economy were actually written in CPR, on industrial policy, on trying to understand what it was that was causing stagnation in industrialization in India. Why was industrial productivity so low? Theoretically, empirically demonstrating that one of the reasons why industrial productivity is low is because of the nature of state intervention, looking at different models. All of this was enabled the creation of an ideas ecosystem that then allowed policymakers that were looking for new ways of breaking the status quo to seek these ideas and then find an opportunity in the policymaking trajectory for when that idea would then be put out into the public domain and convert into policy. None of this happens overnight. So when we are asked about impact, I always shudder because real impact is about building a framework of challenging accepted narratives of policy. That is long, deep, hard work that requires institutions. And that's why one has to think about policy research or think tanks very much as institutions that are trying to shape an ecosystem. And none of this is possible if you're in the process of policy making because you're dealing with the challenges of today. You're seeing that industrial productivity is not being able to achieve its potential. So you're looking at tiny levers. You're not able to look at that big picture. Or maybe you have an intuitive sense over that big picture is, but you don't have the ability to build a political consensus around it because you need all stakeholders to put that pressure. That takes me to the second way in which we engage. So there is the research. Some of this research is often ahead of its time. It's pathbreaking. It doesn't have any takers. It's there and it will get picked up when the moment is right, or it won't, but at least the ideas stay. Some of this research is responding to particular specific policy questions of the moment. What are the kinds of levers I should be adopting today in order to ensure that there are long-term changes? And then some of it is just evidence building. You know, we know, for instance, I'm sitting in Delhi today. I couldn't breathe. I wanted to go for a run in the morning. I couldn't step out of the house. It was a choice. It's not, right now we have this choice of you can either get COVID or you can't breathe. And the reason you can't breathe is because of our air pollution problems. Everybody knows that this is a problem we need to solve. We really don't know how to figure this out. And part of the reason we don't know how to figure this out is because we need to understand what are all the multiple sources of pollution. When do they come into play? How do they interact with each other? What is the role of industrialization? What is the role of urban planning? What is the role of transportation? It requires multiple different expertise to come together in thinking long-term about a wicked problem and building evidence to make it a political problem. So that too becomes part of the research element. All of this to be able to build into a public consensus of change requires that research doesn't stay within the hallowed portals of the center itself. Within academic research and conversations like this, crucial as they are, between us and policymakers, crucial as those are, because real change in democratic environments takes place when you build a new public consensus. And that, in fact, is something that I feel CPR has always recognized. So all our researchers have sometimes almost spent too much time engaging in the public domain. We have a tradition of writing op-eds in national newspapers on an almost daily basis. And all of that is very much part of our modus operandi because we believe it's very important to take your research and build public narratives around those. But in these very fraught political times, that becomes even more crucial because any kind of public debate, public engagement is seen as being polarized and partisan. And I especially when media is as compromised, certainly it is in my country, I think it is some other countries will feel very similarly about what is happening. And a lot about our democracy itself is currently being renegotiated. In these kinds of times, to be able to create that space for socializing of ideas, for building new consensus, for changing how we think about things, to do it from the perspective of policy researchers that engage in the public sphere becomes a very, very important tool. So that's the second thing that we do. And ultimately in democracies, real change only happens when public consensus gets built. So India opened up and changed its economic trajectory very much because there was solid research and a public consensus, and that public consensus was able to also convince political parties and policymakers on the need for this kind of change. And lastly, increasingly now, and I think this comes from this sort of yearning of the state that I was talking about, and also the breakdown of the state that India certainly has experienced, and this challenge of state capacity, there is in India today a very deep disenchantment with the both citizens and frankly the state itself feeling that it actually has the ability to deliver on the core functions of the state. So even health, education, regulation, core functions of the state, I find when I talk to bureaucrats in my country that I as a citizen am more convinced of the Indian state's ability to deliver high quality education if it applied its mind to the problem than the bureaucrat who is the state believes he or she can. And one of the consequences of this, and this I think is a slightly dangerous consequence, is that the state is now constantly looking to stakeholders outside of the state to try and bridge the gap. We call it public-private partnerships, but it's more than that. And that's, I think, where the challenge of state capacity becomes so crucial, where essentially the state is looking to outsource its core functions. Today, you walk into any government office in any part of India at the sort of national and sub-national level, you'll find a large number of people, youngsters in particular, there who are not actually part of the state, but part of PricewaterhouseCoopers, McKinsey, KPMG, NGOs, think tanks who set up little offices inside the state and are providing back office support to an interested bureaucrat or implementing a particular idea that caught the imagination of a politician. Increasingly there is this ask of stakeholders in the policy environment to become the state. Many think tanks are now redefining themselves as and calling themselves do tanks. They're not thinking so much. They're actually doing what the state should do. They think, you know, there is a strong point of view that this is a good thing. I'm a little wary of it, but it certainly is part and parcel of the set of things that we do. I'm wary of it because I believe that the best way to strengthen the state is for the state to reorganize and rebuild its capacities itself, rather than constantly seeking to outsource its capacities to non-state actors. And I believe that good policy comes out of a complex set of compromises. Good policy is about politics. It doesn't sit in, often there are tensions, but you can't have good policy without politics. It never gets implemented well. And so I believe that our role as non-state actors, for lack of a better and more elegant way of putting it, that are trying to be engaged in the policymaking process ought to be one of presenting a menu of solutions or a menu of ideas or a menu of ways in which policymakers can find their pathways out of wicked problems. And contributing to the process of building compromises, of negotiating with vested interests and arriving at solutions that are effective and implementable, and keeping ourselves free to be able to contribute to the public discourse of dissent and critique, because no democracy is successful without high quality dissent and critique. And it's when these lines get blurred that the ability then to step away and to be able to hold truth to power becomes a lot harder. So it's a very blurry line that one has to always be conscious of and reflexive of, I think, as a policy practitioner that is not part of the state.
Great. Those are great ideas. So now time to open up, and I already have many hands and many comments. In the interest of time, maybe if Yamini, you're okay with this, let's combine maybe two or three questions.
Sure.
So Venus, you had the first question, and then I'll repeat Nikhil's question because his mic is not working, and maybe one more. So why don't you, whosoever wants to comment, why don't you introduce yourself and then ask a question?
Sure. So I'm Venus. I'm an MPP student. You mentioned some of the movements that were very anti-incumbent. And so I just wanted to know, given that India's been trying, some parties have been trying to be more progressive, did you find that those anti-incumbent parties also applied to some of the women that were in power as well?
Let me add one more question from Nikhil. Nikhil Srivastav, who is also active in the NGO front in India, is asking about, can you speak a bit on sectors where in India has done well in terms of public policy and sector where it has lacked?
Okay. So let me just clarify that So the phrase anti-incumbency entered the Indian political vocabulary from the point of view of political parties that were in power and were thrown out of power during elections, and the opposition party came in. So it was really very much about the deepening of political party competition. So one of the interesting things about Indian democracy is that we are not a two-party system. We are a multi-party system. And even though today in our central government, at the government of India level, at the national government, we have a single party majority, about 200 plus parties, formal political parties competed in our national elections. It's really about the sort of rollover of political parties, which used to be a very strong feature of our politics in the 1990s and 2000s. It's now changing a little bit. But to your larger question, I think about the role of anti-incumbents, or rather the role, I would say the role of social movements and civil society organizations and progressive politics in shaping policy. I think that India has always had a very vibrant civil society with a repertoire of tools that we in some ways inherited from our independence movement that have always been deployed in its engagement with the state. In the early 2000s, we certainly saw the arrival of a very unique political moment that came about due to a constellation of various factors that created the opportunity for social movements to become part and parcel of the formal process of lawmaking. There's been quite a lot of research that has documented and theorized this process, and I'm happy to share some of that with you, which led to the legislation of a number of social policy legislation aimed at particularly at education, at the right to work, at the right to food, all of which have formed the building blocks of India's welfare state. But our formal political party system has always been anchored in its own very deep vested interests. The extent to which these vested interests have created space for quote unquote progressive voices has always been a very crucial political battle, one that has had some success in that it has certainly been able to open up the formal political sphere and the state to historically discriminated, marginalized communities. But it hasn't been particularly successful in the delivering of social and economic rights, particularly to India's poor. So for a democracy, one of the great puzzles is how is it that we are a democracy that regularly throws governments out, and yet we can't hold our governments accountable for basic public services, health, education being two very crucial ones. Like across the globe, since 2014, India's politics, democratic politics, has also now been moving in the direction of much more strongman politics, much more populist politics that has less space and less willingness to be comfortable with dissent, critique, civic activism. So we are also, like many democracies in the world, in the midst of a deep battle of trying to carve out, and craft new spaces for civic activism to continue to flourish. To the question of can I think of areas where public policy has done well and where it has lagged behind? I think some of the big successes India has had have been if I were to think about India's welfare state, we've done relatively better. There are many warts, no doubt, but we've done relatively better in being able to create a social protection system that is responsive to chronic poverty. In fact, in COVID, that social protection system has come in very, very it's been the lifeline, our public distribution system that distributes free grain to the poor or subsidized grain to the poor, did not reach everyone, but it certainly ensured that it reached a significant majority. Our National Rural Employment Guarantee Program, which was part of this gamut of progressive laws that were legislated in the early 2000s, is a food for work, a work for a public employment program for rural India run by government, has been a source of sustenance for many of India's workers that lost jobs in cities and had to go back to their homes in rural India. It has many problems, but we've been relatively better at that. I think when it comes to the provision of core public goods, the Indian state has been an abysmal failure. Our ability to provide quality education, quality healthcare have been extremely weak. We've been good at putting up the infrastructure. So we have school buildings and teachers, but we don't have the ability to improve the quality of education and a system that actually holds it to account. Similarly for health, we've been relatively good at some forms of regulation, but increasingly the Indian economy is also confronting the fact that in the haste of getting the state out of the way and building in new regulatory structures for managing markets, we didn't pay enough attention to the nuts and bolts of building regulatory institutions that have a strong internal and external accountability systems. And one of the challenges that the Indian economy was facing, even pre-COVID, our economy slowed down considerably, is because of poor quality regulation, which to simplify a very, very complex problem, essentially ensured that some large crony capital was able to consistently reroute loans out of nationalized banks. And as a consequence, banks are now risk averse with relatively little liquidity in them and have caused a serious problem with private investment in the Indian economy as well. So I think the big challenges for India from a public policy point of view in the next decade are about being able to strengthen the state's ability to deliver core public goods and at the same time strengthen the state's ability to build strong, independent regulatory structures that allow the economy to do and allow the market to do what it can well.
Thank you. So we have four more questions so far. I'm reverting to individual questions, so we have, but with the expectation that we can accommodate all of these existing and any future questions. So in this order, Santina, Katie, and Anupama, and Hasti. So Santina first. Why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Santina. I'm an MPP student like Venus. My question is about is a curiosity regarding your work. From a practical point of view, when are set the policies that has a target 10 years from now, 20 years from now? Which are the key variables that people working in the research takes into account?
Take into account for impact or change?
Yes, the ones that you want to control.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Santina, is your question like how do you move from the usual short-term focus of policymakers to and nudge them towards a longer-term focus?
As you said, for example, you were talking about financial regulation, about quality of the regulation or increasing the quality in public in the provision of public good, you think that are the next 10 year targets that we have to take into account. So if you have to do a research to provide some numbers to encourage the policymaker to invest on this point, which are the key variables that you would like to present and to prove that it's important to do that?
Sure. So should I do this one by one or are we taking a cluster of questions?
Up to you.
So I can quickly pick up on this. Let me try and answer this by through an example of what I think has been one of the most powerful shifts in one area of policy in India, of which I've been on some occasions a direct participant and on other occasions an observer. So this is in the field of education, where in the early 2000s, partly in response to a growing demand for education that our politicians were beginning to recognize from the bottom up, and also a universal sort of global push for universalization of education, the Indian government began to, made a big push towards achieving the goal of universalization of education by ensuring access to education for all. And a government program was launched. The World Bank actually gave some funding for it and so on. And the objective was to ensure that all habitations, places where clusters of places where people live, had access to a school within a kilometer. Teachers were hired, school buildings were constructed, so on and so forth. It was a very crucial sort of push towards achieving the target of universalization. Many people who were involved in this process began to see that obviously there were very clear gains as more and more students were getting enrolled into primary schools, but also beginning to feel that despite the fact that children were going to school, there was a big gaping hole in what was happening inside the school. Children were not learning. And in conversations with policymakers, the question of children were not learning was often recognized, but parked. Children are not learning, but first we need to build the schools, we need to get the teachers, we need to train them, we need to do everything else. And it almost felt like people had taken their eye off the ball of the real goal, which was you need to build the school, not to just have children sitting around or playing games all day, but to ensure that they finish school, basic primary school with certain basic core skills. So an NGO that had been working very closely with both governments as well as on its own, innovating with the grassroots, felt that it was really important to, in order to highlight this problem that everybody intuitively recognized, but were not paying enough attention to, one needed to build a really strong base of evidence. And because it was an NGO, it also felt that that base of evidence should not be built just by, five smart researchers sitting in a room, but should be done in a participatory way by trying to bring in a collaborative, larger group of stakeholders into that process. And they began then doing an annual survey of students that were going to within primary school age in across the country. It was a fairly audacious exercise because they just said, we're just going to survey children all across the country and start measuring what they actually know, mapping on to what they should know. The first year they did it, a few people noticed, no one paid any attention, but they consistently built up this evidence year on year on year. So the first variable is building evidence in a sustained manner for the problem that you're trying to solve, to ensure that people begin to sit up and notice that this is a problem in the first place. So this is one example of how they did that. Second, in order to ensure that this evidence enters into the public discourse, you need to build a set of stakeholders around it. So those stakeholders include the media, it includes other academics, it includes other NGOs, it includes policymakers, seeking that change agent within the system and seeking those voices of credibility outside the system that can start building a movement around the evidence that you're generating. And it is, and to recognize that none of this is going to give you that, it's not a magic linear process. We learn often in our textbooks, our funders always ask us, what is your impact? It's like, I woke up one morning, I produced a nice peer review journal article and the whole world sat up and took notice and suddenly, India looks very different. If only it looked like that, the world would be smarter than it is, but it doesn't. It is about seeding these ideas And that means sniffing out, being in the right place at the right time. So, you know, somebody in the state says, in a state government will say, come and make a presentation on X. You go there, you kind of make the presentation on what they had asked you to do, but you also make sure that you insert your ideas in there. You know, make sure that, you know, you're writing about your right. Sometimes it's like, I'm writing about the same thing all over again. Even I'm bored. And every time I publish this, I'm afraid that somebody has read what I've written previously and they shouldn't say, oh, she just cut, copy and paste. So then you have to start thinking of how do you craft the same idea differently. But doing this like a stuck record in a repeated fashion in different frameworks, planting this in different ways, helps then suss out that moment of opportunity when suddenly the idea takes root and people start talking about it. So in the context of this survey of schools, for the first 5 years, no one took notice. 5 years down the line, suddenly the media started picking it up and many other stakeholders began talking about it. There was a whole cohort of data over 5 years. So academics became really interested. More and more people began to discuss, talk, and engage with this idea. And over time, and of course, there's a lot of critique. So, you know, you should know, I always feel when I make a presentation to government with any primary data that I have collected, if they don't start challenging me on my sample size, I'm doing something really wrong. If people listen to you and shrug their shoulders and say, yeah, there must be something in that, then you've not caught anybody's attention. They just want to get rid of you. But if they start critiquing you and challenging you, you know that what you've done is hit the nail on the head and really get them where it hurts. And they want to start finding a way of engaging in a conversation. The first reaction is always to tell you you're wrong. The 10th reaction is to slowly say, okay, you're still wrong, but I'll accept this in some way. And eventually they're going to forget about whether you were right or wrong. You start talking about solutions. So it's a lot about, you know, waiting for the guy that's going to tell you that everything that you've done is wrong, or tell you everything that you're telling me I know and I've already solved. When the guy is telling you they've solved the problem, you know that you're exactly right. That's my happiest moment, is that. So being part of that, embedded in the system, I think is very, very important. That's another variable. How do you find ways of building an ecosystem of around your idea and then embedding yourself within that system for the opportunity to open up for when change may happen. And maybe it won't, but that's okay. You still planted a new idea. So one of the things that I did in my early days at CPR, there had been a lot of, in all this accountability narrative, a lot of talk about opening up government budgets, making them more transparent, linking them to outcomes. What is it that taxpayers' money is actually going for, was all part of the discourse. And at the start, you know, every budget cycle was becoming a media event, partly because 24/7 news channels had also become a big part of what shapes public life in our country and many others. And the conversation always was about how much is the government allocating? You're not prioritizing education. And the other side would say it should be 6% of GDP. Somebody else would say, no, it should be 9% of GDP. Actually, government was only doing 1% of GDP. And we'd go round and round in circles. And from the field, we were running these experiments on participatory planning. And the big problem we were having is we were working with parent-teacher groups in a school, and, you know, LSE's public policy course will tell you a lot about participatory development, and great RCTs will tell you about all the small changes that took place because of parental participation. So we too wanted to be part of that moment and write a paper that will get peer review published. So we're sitting there doing all of this, mobilizing parents, and spending time in villages. And finally, you know, one parent teacher association got activated and made a plan. The plan was very basic and simple. There was a school in the village. The school had a broken roof. The only time when children and teachers could come together without any breaks was, you know, around the monsoon season, the rainy season in India. And that was the time when, because the roof was broken, the classroom would get flooded. So the teacher had an excuse not to show up. So the parents said, look, we want to fix that roof. The rainy season is going to come. So, and the government will, you know, give us this money because we have to make this plan and from government money, that's what we want to do. Sounded sound and sensible and a perfect case study on which to build a whole narrative on participatory development for the Journal of Development. All was well, except that no money showed up. So we waited for a month, we waited for two, the financial year had begun, there was a big debate on the budget when the budget was announced, and every time we would go to the village, the school headmaster would say, well, there's no money in our bank account. And at some point it became really embarrassing because it was clear that that journal article was never going to be written or published. But even more embarrassing, the parents who would come to these meetings told us to take a walk because we were wasting their time as their plan could not be implemented. And then we realized that the problem with how you think about budgets in the public discourse is you always look at prioritization, what is being allocated. You don't look at the process by which that money flows through the system. And so we started this process of tracking actual expenditures, tracking the expenditure calendar of government budgets to see how money flows through the system. Now, in that process, we learned about the anomalies and the inefficiencies of India's public finance management systems. We learned about the lack of transparency. We learned how that suits everybody. We learned how that furthers corruption. We came up with some grand ideas of how we could solve all of this. None of it till today has seen the light of day or been implemented. But what it did do is that it ensured that at least some part of the public debate around budgets started asking the question of monies being spent. It ensured that suddenly the phrase unspent balances came into the public discourse about government budgets. So you're allocating all of this money. Have you spent it? Why have you not spent it? Some people, some NGOs began asking these questions. So we made an ecosystem shift. It hasn't changed public policy. Over 12 years, I've been ad nauseum saying the same thing. Sometimes I used to say it in paper, sometimes I used to say it on television. We still do it. But more and more people are talking about it. That itself is transformatory change. So again, looking for those levers of ideas that you have that you can keep repeating in the ecosystem and finding stakeholders that will share your idea is another important variable.
I think that my question was up next.
Yes, I was unable to unmute myself. So yes, Katie had it.
Perfect. Oops. Well, I'll just go ahead. So I think actually to a large extent, your account of changing the discourse around education is actually probably a really good answer to my question. But I was really interested to learn a bit more about like the political barriers that you face when you've got this amazing policy idea, but it's just hard to get it through. So you mentioned that like part of the role of CPR is to contribute towards building this environment, which allows policies to go through, and that can actually take maybe even decades for the change to actually happen at the policy level. And that there's the role of research and the role of building public pressure and consensus around the issue that contributes to that. So yeah, I was just interested to hear specific examples of that and how that process has played out and how it was able to overcome the kind of internal political barriers.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of classic policy conundrum around how does one actually engage with politics, because at some level politics is the enabler and politics is also the big barrier. There is no perfect answer to this. I think that one of the big worries I have is that in the policy discourse, and I actually at some level, there's a sort of national consensus about this, certainly in India, there's an exhaustion with the political process. And there's a sense that, good policy sometimes sits in tension with with political compulsions, and the ways in which you can get around political compulsions is to push policy through by stealth. Hoodwink the politician or find a politician that is willing to risk and just move it without necessarily building the consensus. In some ways, actually, the story of India in 1991 and how we opened up our economy was also very much about that. It was about the technocrats sort of finding a political player who was willing to, at least for in the early part, build political consensus. But after that, not being able to speak effectively to the political arena. So the policymakers are saying the only way in which India's economy can achieve the next step of its potential is through factor market reforms. What are factor market reforms? Land reforms, labor reforms, many of which are deeply, deeply politically contested issues. And the technocrat is sort of really exhausted with the inability of the politician to forge any of these consensus and is constantly blaming the politician for not doing this. The politician is getting impatient with the technocrat because the politician is not getting the kind of input they need from the technocrat to be able to figure out what's the right way to navigate this very complex sort of terrain. Doing labor reform from capital's perspective is to free up labor of all, it's to free up capital of all constraints and regulations so that they can exploit low-skill labor, which is sort of India, in order to achieve some quote unquote larger, greater good. Land reforms in a complex country like India with a history of complex labor, complex land relations, again, is a highly contested, extremely politically fraught issue. So how do you actually bridge these two? I think in this exhaustion, actually India risks not having this conversation well and constantly looking to see if there were other levers by which change could happen. And I think that is one of the reasons why there was also a push towards strongman politics. One of the reasons why our current political structure looks the way it does, and we've now had a sort of more populist political leader at the national level for now 6 or 7 years, the legitimacy for that kind of political political form came from partly also from an elite consensus that was exhausted with the coalition compromises that politics requires. And I think that exhaustion has come at our own peril, because in that process, when you have strongman politics and majoritarian politics of a certain kind in democratic settings, it seeks to close off spaces of critique, dissent, activism, and create an environment that is so politically polarizing that feedback loops don't come in. So, very recently, our current government at the national level used the COVID economic crisis as an opportunity to do what they call, a big agriculture reform, big reform in agriculture markets. Now, no one in their right mind in India will argue that Indian agriculture is not in serious need of reform, and some part of that reform is around liberalizing agriculture markets to offer better and more competitive pricing to farmers. But doing something like this in a way that genuinely empowers farmers requires brokering multiple forms of consensus across different types of vested interests. Because we wanted strongman pushing, these laws were rammed through. The laws themselves are inadequate, badly conceptualized, in my opinion. Of course, you will get a very different opinion if you talk to somebody from the political party itself. But more importantly, there has been no space for consensus building and for confidence building. So you've got now widespread farmer protests in some of the most crucial parts of India whose agriculture markets and agriculture policies shape food and agriculture policy across the rest of the country. And any further reform, particularly around subsidies, are going to be much harder because we've broken that space for political compromise to be brokered. So I think that there's a very important need for people like us, students of public policy, to be much more reflective about the role of politics. And think harder about what will it take to try and build these long-term political consensus around critical ideas, rather than falling into the trap of getting exhausted with politics and wanting to rid ourselves of the politics to get things done.
Great, thanks. So we have two more questions. So in the interest of time, let me say, let's have all of those questions are asked simultaneously. So Anupam first and then Hasti.
Hi, I'm Anupama. I'm from India. And prior to the MPA program, I worked in the government school sector in India, public education sector in India. And like you were mentioning earlier, one of the things that really stood out in my experience was how a lot of these bigger challenges were really boiled down to mere administrative roadblocks. Instead of focusing on the major learning challenges, administrative challenges were really focused at. So I was wondering, especially at these local levels, what makes these stakeholders and these bureaucrats not really focus on outcomes, but rather on inputs and outputs? And how do you possibly like align their mission and vision to the larger goal and to the larger goal that is required? So like, is it the incentive structure? Is it the accountability structure? What really is the reason behind this non-alignment? So, yeah.
Thank you, Anupam. Hasti?
Thank you so much for your insightful lecture. I'm Hasti, I'm from India as well. And I'm pursuing a master's in public administration at LSE. So my question is a bit general. As we've done just 2 months of master's in administration, I've like got to know many challenges, like, and I've like become very negative right now, that how am I going to bring about the change that I've thought I want to. And I resonate a lot with you when you said about your interest in PhD, like you don't find that interesting, and you also wanted to focus more on how state delivers its duty. Even I have that kind of inclination. So I just wanted to know your advice on how should we build our mindset as we progress in this journey, that in spite of all these challenges and the time lag that takes, that's required for good policy implementation, how can we keep stable and continuously, trying to bring about that change that we thought initially? How should we build our mindset in that manner? Thank you.
Okay, so to the first question, Anupma, you get to the heart of the challenge of state capacity in India. My own thinking on this is that I think we have concentrated a lot on the questions of what does it take and what are the conditions under which big reform ideas enter the system. So even with education, you see a lot of now policy elites, both politicians as well as senior officials. And in fact, our national education policy now recognizes the importance of foundational learning, focusing on learning outcomes, et cetera, et cetera. But what we haven't really focused on is what are the conditions under which these ideas actually translate into reshaping and changing the way the bureaucracy functions at the point of implementation. A lot of my recent research, I started out by being interested in the bottom-up citizen to state element of this. So how do citizens place claims on the state? Because ultimately in a democracy, it is citizen demand that shapes how governments behave. I spent some part of my policy career in the heady corridors of power, where big policies are debated and discussed. But really for me, the heart of the question is at this intersection between the big policy ideas and their translation and the creation of these pathways. You know, why is it that money doesn't reach the school? You can have the best policy in the planet. You can have citizens ready to demand, but you have a system that is just not designed to be able to be responsive to that demand. I've often framed this in my writing and work as the challenge of sort of rules versus responsiveness. And that has to do a lot with the fact that the Indian state is sort of designed to function in a rule-based structure that constrains it from actually empowering the state to take the right kind of decisions at the right level. Every time I have engaged with bureaucrats at the grassroots, especially when bureaucrats are being asked to reform their behaviors, do things differently, they are constrained by the culture and the sociology of the bureaucracy. They operate on the basis of rules, government orders, circulars that are sent. I've just recently completed a study of education reform in my city in Delhi in government schools. And we tracked a database of 8,000 government circulars that were written and issued. And Adnan probably wrote many of similar kinds of circulars in his days. But it is the circular that dominates what a bureaucrat does. It is a circular and the ask of that circular that determines how the bureaucrat understands their own understandings of performance. It is a hierarchical structure that dominates how they view what they are supposed to do. But the ask of them on the ground is to actually break free of those hierarchies. So if a citizen is coming and saying, I want to fix the roof of my school, is the headmaster or the education officer at the grassroots level actually freed of these rules to be able to use the funds they have to say, okay, go ahead, fix the roof. It makes sense. I'm at the grassroots. I know what to do. I think particularly in the context of the Indian state, in fact, Pakistan is much better at this than we are. The extent of centralization and embeddedness of hierarchy has created a delivery culture that makes it very hard for the grassroots bureaucracy where implementation happens to cohere around goals of accountability for outcomes. I wanted to do this as a systematic study, but didn't collect the data in a way that would stand up to scrutiny, so never really published it. But we did a series of interviews with frontline bureaucrats. And one of the questions we asked them was, what is your definition of public service? And to me, what was fascinating in the Indian context is that definition of public service wasn't around, you know, I want to ensure that all children in my jurisdiction go to school or learn something or everybody gets access to high quality health. It was always about, public service for me is to implement the scheme according to these three rules that I have been told. You know, so it is the scheme and it is the rule that dominates and your notion of performance is linked to that. And I think that constrains because policy is asking something very different. Demands of citizens on the state are also transforming because of democracy deepening, transforming because citizen aspirations are changing, transforming because citizens now know what to ask of their the art of democracy and the practice of citizenship is deepening in countries like India, yet the state is unable to reform itself. So for me, the challenge of state capacity is about reimagining the architecture of the state, reimagining where power is located in the state, and reimagining how the state's internal culture and organization holds itself accountable differently. To your question, it is easy to be pessimistic, but I would urge you not to be. Every time I feel like one is talking into an echo chamber and talking to oneself, I solve the problem by going to the field. So my advice to anybody that asks me, you know, how do you start a career in public policy, at the risk of not accessing talent that we really need in research institutions, my advice is always spend a few years in the field, whether it is through grassroots research, through activism, through practice, actually participating in the processes that you want to study, research on, and shape policy on, so that many years later, when you're stuck in air-conditioned rooms, you can still close your eyes and imagine the person, the school, the teacher, the block officer, in whose name you're discussing complex policy problems, who often are not part of that grammar. We speak a vocabulary that most people don't. I did say that I chose not to do a PhD. I have to say that with hindsight and middle-aged wise reflection, I think that that was a bad decision. I think that it sort of depends really on your own person and where you want to, what attracts you as an individual, because ultimately the best jobs are those that keep you excited and engaged, and there's no perfect path. But I do think that what a PhD does is to train your mind into the discipline of long-term, in-depth search for answers to questions or seeking to ratify hypotheses. And that, I think, is an important skill to have, because in the field of public policy, you're not going to see change tomorrow. It is about long-term, deep, embedded work. And that work can be in the form of being of practice, it can be in the form of research, it can be by building institutions, it can take many forms. And ultimately, I think, three things that I've learned. I think the best job is a job where you find a good mentor, especially early on. That's not easy that's not easy. And I have been incredibly lucky and blessed to have always found good mentors wherever I am. But the environment of the place you are in probably makes the most difference to the kinds of career opportunities and choices you will make in your life. I think, secondly, the field of public policy is an evolving one. All the institutions that were well established, whether on the global stage or at the local national stage, are going through their own moments of transition across the world. The state itself is being questioned in many different ways, and the relationship that citizens are forging with their states, democracies or authoritarian across the world, are looking very different. And so think of your career as a long-term trajectory, in which being entrepreneurial is going to be a very important thing. You know, there is no set path. You can't imagine yourself as saying, I'll start as a research associate in a think tank and end up as the director of that think tank. There's no set path. You will craft that path. So be open to all the choices that you have. And I think, especially for all the women in the group, life is complex and always brings many challenges. But the one thing that I've always felt is that the ability to be agile and reinvent oneself in a way that allows one to be able to be to be responsive to the particular life moment and professional context in which you are really helps to navigate what is what can be a complex world. The world of policy often tends to be very male dominated. In countries like India, it's also extremely age dominated. I remember I thought that the big transition I made professionally when we were first doing a lot of these expenditure tracking surveys, we would have to get permission from government bureaucrats to do the surveys. And every time we'd walk into these offices, they would always, no one would be willing to talk. There was always this expression of hierarchy and seniority that was spread. And some years later, I walked into a meeting and, suddenly the person sitting across the desk actually looked up and started engaging in a conversation with me in a way that, I was suddenly being treated as an equal. And I walked out of that meeting feeling very chuffed with myself, thinking now my work is finally speaking for me, until it also dawned on me that I am also now 5 years older than when we started out with this project. And the little bits of gray hair that were popping out suddenly made it okay for this bureaucrat to talk to me. So, I kept that in mind and ensured that I held my own no matter what, and would sit there and insist that all these gray-haired bureaucrats would look up and talk to me. So it is a difficult world that we have to navigate. But as long as we are confident in what we are doing, you know, the world is ours, and we are at the cusp of grand changes. So don't let any of that get you down.
Wonderful. That was really insightful. I think all of us will agree that this was a unique occasion, very insightful, very candid, very personal, but at the same time, very insightful. So I'm particularly intrigued at this lifelong quest or like a struggle whether to do or to be or not to be, to do a PhD or not to do, that I also confronted for many decades before finally doing it at an age where half of the class was perhaps half my age. So,
well, so, it was. I did at one point set myself a goal actually that at 40, if I wasn't sure what I was doing, I will go and do a PhD, and then you know. Suddenly, CPR presidency opened up an opportunity. So I had to say, okay, well, that's more exciting. So I'll write that book eventually.
So thank you very much. So I think all of us, can we turn our videos on for a moment so that